The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Can we work it out? Have Varadkar and Johnson found a path to a deal in Liverpool? ISIS bride Lisa Smith could face charges for terrorist offences. As fears grow that Trump's move in Syria will see thousands of ISIS prisoners freed. And Extension Rebellion, uncooperative crusties or brave eco-warriors highlighting an inconvenient truth. But first the news with Sharon Gagan. Thanks, Sharon. Good evening and welcome to The Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan and joining me tonight I have Fianna Fáil spokesperson on defence and TD for Dublin West, Jack Chambers, Fine Gael councillor for Dunleary Rathdown and general election candidate Barry Ward, Gerry Boyle, director of Chagask, Aisling Wheeler of Extinction Rebellion, Harry McGee, political correspondent for the Irish Times and environmental journalist John Gibbons. Now we want to hear from you, so get those phones out and be ready to text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @LateDebateRTE. Now, those of you who are paying attention to our panel lineup there will have noted that it includes a number of commentators who will have strong views on what we should or should not be doing as we face a climate emergency. So we will be devoting much of tonight's programme to that discussion. But first, we have to turn to today's possibly major developments on Brexit. Here's a flavour of what an unusually upbeat Taoiseach had to say after his three-hour private meeting with Boris Johnson in Liverpool today.
Of course, issues yet to be fully resolved. The first is the issue of consent and democracy. The second is the whole issue of customs, ensuring that there is no customs border between North and South. We had a good discussion looking forward to how relationships might look after Brexit. I think all sides would like there to be an agreement next week at the Council if possible. Obviously there's a further deadline after that, which is the 31st of October, so I would say a short pathway rather than a long one, but it's impossible to predict that for sure. So I will ask you once again, try to see it my way. I think it is possible for us to come to an agreement, to have a treaty agreed to allow the UK to leave the EU in an orderly fashion and to have that done by the end of October. But there is many a slip between cup and lip and lots of things that are not in my control.
Many a slip between cup and lip. I'm joined on the line now by Irish independent political correspondent Hugh O'Connell, who was in Liverpool with the Taoiseach today. Hugh, is this it? Has there been a real breakthrough?
Well, I think we, you know, we should acknowledge that there does seem to have been significant progress today. At least the very fact, I suppose, that there was effectively a bilateral meeting between Boris Johnson and Leo Varadkar would suggest that there's an acknowledgement on the Irish side, at least, that, you know, despite repeatedly saying over the last 3 years that talks would have to take place between the EU task force on Brexit and the government and the UK government, there does have to be a bilateral element to try and break the impasse. And from what we know of the talks today, there was a lot of tic-tacking between Irish officials and the Brexit task force in Brussels on what was being discussed with Boris Johnson and his team at Thornton Manor, which is about 16 kilometres west of Liverpool. But as to whether we've reached a point now where a deal is imminent, I would be cautious about saying that that is the case. But certainly the Taoiseach, when he gave a brief press conference at Liverpool Airport before he flew back to Dublin, gave the impression that a deal, I mean, in fact, in his own words, said that he believed the deal was now possible within the next 3 weeks before the October 31st deadline. That's a pretty tight time frame. But he certainly displayed an air of confidence that I think took me out, was surprising to those of us heading over to Liverpool this morning who didn't expect much by way of a breakthrough. But the very fact that, as I said, they met bilaterally, and they met for a lot longer than we had expected. We thought the meeting would be an hour and a half, to ended up being twice as long as that. So we do seem to have made, or there does seem to have been some progress today, but
And just listening,
there's a lot of hurdles to clear before we can say that there's definitively going to be
this
a deal.
Is on, yeah. But just listening to what the Taoiseach was saying, they're listening to it again just now. There does seem to have, or he seems to have, managed to get some movement on this customs issue.
Yeah, so the customs issue is effectively that the proposal that had been previously put forward by the UK was dismissed as not credible by the EU and by Ireland, in the sense that it was creating a situation whereby there would be a customs border and customs posts and checks on the island of Ireland, and this was not something that could fly. I mean, essentially, you know, the Irish government position has always been that there needed to be a frictionless border, that there needed to be no checks and no controls along the border, and that there would be a mechanism in place that would facilitate frictionless trade across the Irish border, acknowledging the fact that it's a 500-kilometre border, long border, nearly 500 kilometres long, and it had over 300 separate crossing points.
Was there any? I know we saw the press conference, obviously, that you were at. Was there any chat around that? Any sense of what that progress might be? Because obviously, the chatter already is developing that this may mean that the DUP has been cut loose.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, it's no, you know, the Taoiseach was loath to get into much detail about what was discussed. You know, he kind of took the view that the talks are now at a very, very sensitive stage. And, of course, this meeting was shrouded in secrecy. It was only through, you know, the kind of endeavours of myself and my colleagues that we found out where the meeting actually took place today, and we were there earlier on. But, you know, he's preaching caution in terms of, you know, setting out what's happened. But from what we know and what we've, you know, people we've been talking to in recent hours, there does seem to be the suggestion that the British have moved on this customs issue and that they have relented somewhat and agreeing perhaps that there would be no sort of customs border on the island of Ireland or customs checks on the island of Ireland. But that's likely to meet with some pushback, obviously, from the hardline Brexiteers. I mean, we've heard some of them in recent days saying what the British had put forward originally, or what Boris Johnson had put forward in recent weeks, was at the limit of what they could accept. And the idea that they would cave on that, and as you said, would cut loose the DUP, is likely to meet with opposition from within Boris Johnson's own party and from the DUP. So that's why I say that there's a lot of hurdles to clear. I mean, you know, there could be a situation whereby Boris Johnson might crack a deal with the EU, and that gets done at the European Council next week. That's an optimistic outlook, but that when he brings that to the House of Commons after that, it could run into some difficulties. So, and that's a concern shared in Brussels as well, I think. But, you know, a lot of people I was speaking to tonight were pointing towards the UK Brexit Secretary meeting with Michel Barnier, the EU's Brexit negotiator, tomorrow morning, where it's expected afterwards Barnier will make a call on whether they can go into these negotiations in what's known as the tunnel, secret negotiations, secret talks that where they hammer it out and emerge with an actual deal.
Okay, I'll leave you go, Hugh O'Connell. Thank you for joining us with that this evening. Barry Ward, are you any the wiser as to where this might be going?
You'd be surprised to learn that I haven't. And I think one of the things Hugh said there is very important, is that talks are at a very sensitive stage, so it's appropriate that it's not being discussed in public. I think it's certainly encouraging, though. The length of the meeting is an indicator. If a deal can be done, I have faith that it will be done, because I do believe all parties want it. It's not in anybody's interest to allow this to just slip into some kind of a no deal or anything like that. So it's promising, and hopefully it'll come to fruition.
Harry, how are you reading it this evening?
You can be sure as night follows day that Boris Johnson has cut a Mephistophelian deal that with the devil that will save his own skin, but certainly alienate the DUP. And
let me just put you, because just as we were coming on air, Ben Lowry, who is of course the deputy editor of the Belfast Newsletter and has some insight into DUP thinking, he was on prime time and he was saying that given Leo's delight, it looks like Johnson is giving ground on the customs issue, and he says, I can't see the DUP supporting that, so he must think he can get it through without them, and that there'll be very bad feeling across the unionist spectrum if that is what has happened.
Yeah, I mean, the compromise is definitely coming from the British. Actually, yesterday I spoke to a really senior member of government who I bumped into, and they expressed optimism that a deal could be struck by the end of the month. And I kind of said, that's just been
crazy talk.
Crazy talk. So in my kind of analysis, my analysis concurred with the rest of the flock that it was going to be a run-of-the-mill meeting at which nothing would happen. But it seems that the British have conceded. Dennis Staunton has an interesting snap analysis piece in The Times where he's talking about Northern Ireland being in a kind of a hybrid state. It's out of the customs union, but any goods coming into it from Britain will be checked beforehand, and the tariffs that would apply in Europe will apply to the goods going in. And then once they're in, those who have been charged a higher tariff by Europe can claim a rebate from the UK government. So they're kind of outside the customs union, but they're also inside the customs union. But that effectively means, in real politic terms, a border along the Irish Sea, in real form or in intangible form. That's going to alienate the DUP and many members of the European Research Group. And again, we'd have to look at the arithmetic of Westminster to see if such a deal will be possible from Tory MPs who will back it, plus those Labour MPs who are keen for Britain to leave the EU.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be a huge problem. Well, whatever deal somehow magically might have been pulled out of the fire here, Jack Chambers, getting it through customs, because you say the ERG group are going to be looking to the DUP. If the DUP are unhappy, that's going to cause problems. Even if he brings back on board all those Tories that were thrown out of the party and lost the whip in recent times, he will still need some Labour people to come on board. And why would Labour reach out a hand to Boris Johnson at this point in time?
Well, it's interesting, just first of all, to say that the language is strong, and it's welcome that there is encouraging signs from the Taoiseach, and from an Irish position, that's welcome. I think also the language from the Taoiseach around not wanting to show that there are any concessions on either side, I think, is important at this sensitive stage. In terms of, yeah, I mean, we've been here before. We've had a deal. We've had Theresa May bring it back to Parliament, and we saw the consequences there. I can remember Rees Mogg actually in recent weeks kind of referring to nearly the unionist veto within the Tory party, and I think it'll be interesting whether that plays true in the coming days. But look, I think this could be part of, you know, I think Boris Johnson has made a calculation that, you know, if there's an extension, the Brexit party potentially rockets within the UK. You have, and he doesn't get an election either. So you've got an extension, you've got diminishing Tory support, and you've got no election. If he brings a deal to Parliament, then suddenly the responsibility switches to the other side. And I think that'll be an interest to see how it plays out. But clearly, the language and the bilateral discussion today was positive. Even the you know, the discussion on how officials were engaging, the fact that we've got the EU's task force meeting tomorrow. And the fact that Michel Barnier yesterday basically closed off negotiations tomorrow, if there's positive indications from him, I think it's encouraging from an Irish perspective. But we are at an early stage. We've been here before, and I think from an Irish perspective, we have to, I suppose, hope for the best but prepare for the worst.
Yeah, there'll be concessions, actually. I should say there'll be concessions from the Irish side too. I'm sure of that. They mightn't be as dramatic as those that have, or that Boris Johnson is prepared to make, but I believe that there will have to be some concessions from the Irish side. Maybe
Boris couldn't possibly take it back to Parliament without some give.
Maybe putting some kind of a time limit on it, or using language that suggests a time limit. Maybe being kind of creatively ambivalent with the language in terms of creative.
But is there not a danger, though, that what we've learned of Boris Johnson, if we've learned anything, even in this last week, is that he tells everyone he meets exactly what they want to hear at that particular time?
I think the language of, say, customs and consent were the two words they focused on, and clearly the concentrations are going to come back to Stormont to actually where power could be devolved in a greater way. But clearly that's where they see this being resolved. Mind you, the last number of years wouldn't give much hope for that, the way the Sinn Féin of the DUP have acted, so who knows?
Yeah, but anyway, one way or another, we're in a very different space this evening than we thought we would be even 24 hours or even 10 hours or 5 hours ago. Okay, we will move on because I want to move on to our main discussion this evening. This has been a big week for Extension Rebellion. Not just this week, in the past, they've glued themselves to the door of the Department of Climate Action. This week, they've been disrupting Dublin rush hour traffic with a slow cycle protest. They've occupied Pennies in a protest over fast fashion. There was the march through Dublin City Centre on Monday. There was that very noisy protest outside the Dáil on Budget Day. And then today, we learned from reports from City Airport in London of this protest.
Today there's a protest at this airport.
Sorry.
We have two generations of human civilization left. If we carry on doing what we're doing, because I need to keep on board.
I hope this is going on live. So this is all about the climate and ecological crisis. We're protesting against government inaction on climate and ecological breakdown. They declare a climate emergency.
And the first there, the sound quality was poor there, but for good reason. The first was inside a plane, an Aer Lingus plane that was leaving for Dublin, where a protester made a speech and refused to take his seat and was removed from the plane. And the second was a protester who actually climbed on top of a BA plane and had to be, again, removed. So does the scale of the climate emergency demand this kind of extreme action? Are we sleepwalking into a climate catastrophe? Aisling Wheeler, you're a member of Extinction Rebellion. You've been protesting this week. What are you hoping to achieve?
Well, Extinction Rebellion Ireland has three demands. So the first one is tell the truth, and that's a message for the government and the media, that we need proper, real information about climate change and about the disastrous consequences of not acting now. The second demand is to act on this truth and to reduce emissions to zero by 2030. Our third demand is that, so this is a big transition to a carbon-free society, and we want it to be a just transition, equitable and fair for everybody, not just carbon taxing the poor people. And it's actually a great opportunity to restructure our economy and make things fairer for everybody.
And we were looking at this, sorry to cut across, but we were just looking at the protests from London Airport this evening and in London all this week as well. There was a lot, I think something like 1,000 protesters arrested over the course of the week. Boris Johnson taking a very hard line in relation to what has been the reaction to your own protests on the streets of Dublin?
Well, it's like quite mixed. You know, some people are walking by and going, yeah, great, go for it. Lots of people are coming and talking to us. We're doing a lot of public outreach, talking to people, getting them to come along to our camp at Merrion Square, where we have lots of different things going on. We've had a really interesting talk today about food and farming. We have had a fantastic anti-fracking activist from Argentina over. He just arrived today. He's actually had to leave his country because he's in fear of his life because of how successful he's been at raising awareness and stopping fracking in Argentina. So we have a lot of interesting people, a lot of interesting talks going on. You know, some people are annoyed at the disruption, and I can completely understand that, and we are really sorry about that. But this is an emergency. It's a disaster. And even though a lot of the politicians are starting to say the right things, and we're really happy about that, politicians from all parties, we need the action. We need policies that are going to reduce emissions and tomorrow, today, yeah. Last year.
Well, Barry Ward, there, like what Aisling is saying, there is a lot of talk. People are talking the talk now, but is the political will there to actually make real progress on this?
Yeah, I think it is. I suppose the difference that I would make between what Aisling has said is and what the government is doing.
Would you support those Extinction Rebellion
lots of
protests?
Them I would. I mean, lots of the ideas I do, I'm behind, and you can see in my record in terms of what I've done politically, environmental policies are to the fore. But
in terms of shutting down cities and
I don't agree
disrupting.
With that, because I don't think that's going to achieve the list of aims that Aisling has outlined. And what I was going to say was the difference between what she has said and what the government is doing is, you know, the reality of the situation. We cannot solve this problem overnight, and shutting everything down is not going to solve this problem overnight either. It's not a realistic solution. So I think you have to approach this from the perspective that you can actually get things done in a way that is sustainable. And I don't necessarily just mean environmentally sustainable, but economically sustainable as well.
But if you believe we are facing extinction, that's the view of this movement. Shutting down the city is surely a small price to pay if it's going to wake people up to what...
No, because I don't think it's sustainable. What do you do after you've shut down the city? What
shutting down the city is to get people's attention. We are the alarm bell. Our own president has said we are up to our neck in dead canaries. And what are we doing? Just stomping over them and going down the coal mine further. You know, this we need people to understand how serious it is.
The question, what do you do after you've shut down the city? How do you feed people? How do you continue with the
society? No, sorry, we're not talking... We're shutting down the city for the week to draw attention to get politicians to act and to make proper policies.
Well, I suppose I would take
we do need to localise the economy. I agree with you on that. And we do probably need to have either people either to make cities smaller or to have more farming and more food production and more localised services within cities. Yes, we do need to do that. I'm not talking about shutting down cities.
OK, I'll just give you a flavour of just the initial reaction on to this discussion. Extension Rebellion are doing nothing constructive, says one Gordon on Twitter. We all know climate change is occurring. They don't really have solutions, but things they advocate are seriously simplistic answers to extremely complex problems. We have another texter in here. The only inconvenient truth is that the hard extremist eco-left have jumped on the deluded and media-enabled climate bandwagon as a means to overthrow capitalism. I think you wouldn't mind if capitalism was overthrown, really, Aisling, but I will come back to that in a moment. And then I have another one here. I live near Merrion Square and couldn't sleep on Tuesday night as the protesters were up partying late into the night. I walked through Merrion Square the following morning and they were all sound asleep. The Friday strikes have public support. The extension mob are in public nuisance and should go back to work. John Gibbons.
Yeah, I think as Aisling said, this is an emergency situation, whether people like it or not. The Oireachtas on the 10th of May last declared a climate and biodiversity emergency. That followed really probably from the school strike on the 15th of March, which probably was the jolt, the first real jolt that the political system has had here in terms of an awareness, I think, that penetrated Leinster House, that there is, this is actually a popular movement. This is not a few crusties. This sweeps right across. And it's also an intergenerational movement, and particularly a movement that has been spearheaded by younger people who've come to realise that our generation, my generation, have sold them down the river. Our political classes have failed absolutely and utterly on this issue. What they have done, and I'll give you a quick figure on this, since globally we've really got our heads together, since about 1990, the Intergovernmental Panel was brought together, where all the nations on Earth were going to get together to solve climate change. In the intervening three decades, what has happened is global emissions have doubled in the time that we have known that we face a crisis. So what we have here is a failure of politics on a global scale and on a catastrophic scale. And that failure of politics is the reason why people are on the streets today. If you look at other failures of politics, whether it was in relation to the women's right to vote, the civil rights movement, or indeed this country's ability to achieve its own freedom, all of these things were mediated on the streets. And I think that's what we're seeing now, trying to negotiate with politicians. Leo Varadkar, for example, I think his Taoiseach now is 2.5 years. In all that time, he has met representatives from the environmental NGO sector once. And that happened about a week or two ago, and I believe it was a little bit of a fig leaf, just to say, well, I've ticked that box. Now, you ask yourself the question, how many times has he met the agricultural lobby? How many rugby matches has he gone to with them in the same time?
And how many times has he met oil and gas lobbyists? 50. And he's met climate activists once.
Okay. Well, you mentioned there the agriculture lobby, because agriculture, of course, is a huge issue. If we bring it back home to Ireland, and it's a particular issue in this country because, unlike a lot of other European countries, it accounts for a third of our total greenhouse gas emissions, and 90% of total nitrous oxide emissions, 85% of methane emissions. Gerry, can Irish agriculture become sustainable, environmentally sustainable?
Well, first of all, I'm not a member of the agriculture lobby. I just want to make that point. But yes, I believe it can. We have signed up, Ireland has signed up to the burden-sharing agreement, and that requires a 30% reduction in emissions by 2030. The government has published the Climate Action Plan, laid out targets which we believe are achievable on the basis of the agricultural sector. Emissions pretty much follow the trajectory of livestock numbers. It's a fairly strong relationship.
And that trajectory has been going
No, total livestock numbers are pretty constant. In fact, last year they would have fallen. Beef cow numbers have fallen by about 3.5% last year.
Oh, dairy went up by 2.
Sorry, Jerry. I'm speaking. Dairy went up by 2. So there's a balancing there going on. Overall, livestock numbers were reduced last year, actually.
So now, is it that since the quotas were lifted and the dairy herds were increased, that beef herds fell? Is that what you're...
Yeah, well, of course, there would have been a lot of beef produced on dairy farms because they weren't able to produce milk, as much milk as they would have liked to under the dairy quota. So dairy farmers pretty much have no beef cows anymore at this stage, 3 or 4 years after the elimination of quota. So livestock numbers are key, really, into the future. But also there are technologies that are available out there that we have researched, published in peer refereed journals, that demonstrate, for example, take one simple example, we know if we change the type of nitrogen that farmers use, that will eliminate both greenhouse gas emissions and ammonia emissions. And technology will change.
So why aren't all farmers using that?
Well, I think, this is a really important point. I mean, it really was until June of this year that we got clarity as to what was expected of the sectors from government in terms of the establishment of targets. Personally, I think targets should have been established a long time ago because they do galvanise attention. We still don't really have a policy in place yet to either incentivise or disincentivise activity on farms. I expect that the next round of the CAP will be very much about sustainability, and that will be a huge driver. So at the moment, what we have in the agricultural sector in terms of instruments to influence is, say, what I might call moral suasion, you know, is persuading and pointing out to the agricultural sector what options are available to.
But, you know, I was all around the country in the run-up to the European election debate, and I talked to a lot of farmers in marts and on their farms all over the country. And I did meet farmers that were very environmentally aware and were doing, you know, some fairly, you know, interesting things to try and make their farms more sustainable. But the bulk of the farmers I met felt that they were under siege. They were talking about the vegans coming to get them. There was a sense that it was a them, an us and them. I didn't get the sense that there was much moral persuasion working there.
Yeah, no, look, this is a very difficult challenge because you're talking about behavioural change. And I would have to agree with you. The awareness, not so much of the general issue around climate change, there is an awareness of that, but of what farmers can do to mitigate and indeed to adapt to climate change. That awareness is quite limited at the moment. I would say, for example, in relation to ammonia emissions, which we're probably, if anything, think is more urgent, there's very little awareness. So there has to be a very intensive communication campaign.
But how could there be very little awareness of these very crucial issues at this late stage of the day? Is that not a failure in itself?
No, what I said was there's a generalised awareness, certainly of greenhouse gases. It's less intense when it comes to ammonia emissions. What farmers really need to learn, and we're working with them very closely to try and achieve this, and with the processing sector and so on, is the measures that farmers can take on their own farms to mitigate. And that is challenging because farmers are used to using certain technologies. That will be persuaded to change. That will take time, and it will also take policy initiatives as well.
Ashley, you are a farmer yourself.
Yep.
What do you farm?
Poultry and vegetables. So not in this sector, but all my neighbours are beef and dairy farmers. And I think realistically, methane is much worse than carbon, and that's where all our agricultural emissions are methane. Reducing, because we are in such a serious situation, the reduction of methane could buy us some time, because reducing methane will have a more immediate effect, and reducing carbon we need to do it, but the time lag is longer.
And pretty much all the methane is being belched by livestock.
Well, in Ireland, yes, because we have banned fracking, but we have, you know, fracking going on all over the world, and possibly, there's this proposed terminal to bring frack gas into the Shannon Estuary. So it's a whole other issue. But reducing methane from whatever sources can buy us some time here. And so we've got to diversify our agriculture. I really don't see another option.
Okay, can I just because I want to move on to other issues in this. John, respond to what Jerry was saying there.
Yeah, a couple of things. I think what didn't really come across very clearly, I think, was the fact that our agricultural emissions are on a trajectory in exactly the opposite direction of where they need to be going. Right across the sector, emissions have increased by about 8% since about 2015. This is at a time when nationally we were supposed to be reducing our emissions from 2005 to 2020 by 20%, which of course a third of that is agriculture. So how can we possibly be achieving any national emissions targets when the largest individual sector is going in the opposite direction? And this is policy driven. No matter what you do, you can tinker around the edge with anaerobic digesters and a few other things. Some of them, by the way, like splash plates, very useful, particularly in relation... Thank you. Anyway, and so on. There are certain technologies that are quite useful, and even from an air quality point of view and air pollution point of view, we need to implement. But the key thing here is that agricultural emissions are driven by policy. And that policy is informed by two documents, FoodWise 2020 or Food Harvest 2020, FoodWise 2025. These are documents that are essentially written by the agricultural industry, well, specifically by the agricultural processing industry. And what it's about is maximising output of the two areas, beef and dairy, that maximise our emissions, and particularly our ruminant emissions, pushing up our total emissions from the sector. And there is no way other than reducing the national herd significantly and dramatically. And I would say, by the way, that the Climate Change Advisory Council, Professor John Fitzgerald and his council, have endorsed this position. We have to reduce it. And people say, well, you can't cut the national herd. Nobody said when we added on 300,000 dairy cows that we can't increase the national herd. And we did that at exactly the time that we need to be reducing our emissions. And that's why the agricultural sector is a huge failure.
Jerry.
I am actually a member of the Climate Change Advisory Council, so I contribute to that report. I have to disagree fundamentally with John. I mean, for a start, the fact is that, as I explained at the beginning, total livestock numbers are actually falling marginally at the moment. And I don't think... it's unreasonable to project stability out to 2030.
Well, that's not what the Environment Protection Agency says. It predicts greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture are on course to increase steadily over the coming years.
No, based on that's our projection. We provide that to Chagas. Provide the projections. I'm saying in relation to livestock numbers, there is stability. But of course, the challenge really is to harness the mitigation options that are there, and we have demonstrated. And they haven't been challenged. They're published, as I say.
But does there not have to be a step change? When you're looking at, if emissions have gone up by 8% since 2015, at a time when we're supposed to be all hands on deck trying to deal with this,
Absolutely. I mean, I was speaking at a conference last 2 weeks ago in Belgium, and we all agreed, all of the research agencies around Europe, that we're talking about transformational change. If you want, for example, to get dairy farmers to switch entirely the type of fertilizer they're using, that's a transformational change. And we know the evidence is there to say that will...
Why isn't that happening? That's what I'm asking.
I think there are two issues. First of all, it has to be explained to farmers that this
technology... Why don't we just ban the emission-producing fertilizer and only allow the...
Here speaking on behalf of policy, but certainly if you look at options, regulation certainly will make a difference. No question about that. So that may very well happen.
I want to let our political voices in on this. Jack Chambers, obviously the agriculture lobby is a powerful one and always has been in this country. Do you accept that what Jerry is saying there, we have to work with farmers, we have to persuade them that they need to, you know, make these small changes on the farm and that there will be an incremental change? Or do we need some radical moves here?
I agree with Jerry. I mean, it's a change, it's a transition for farmers like it is for many citizens. And I think to just turn the lights off tomorrow, what does that do for people who are already really threatened with Brexit, for example? And we've had beef farmers protesting outside processing plants because of their incomes. What I found refreshing from the Climate Action Committee was that both, if you take the climate experts and the agricultural lobby, there was an acceptance that agriculture has to change, that it has to diversify, that we need to enhance biodiversity.
But when we have a policy document that says that demands huge increases in output from the agricultural sector, So where are we going?
Well, what we need to do is incentivize farmers to diversify. But there's also, Chagas had, I think, over 30 recommendations around how this can be managed and how we can reduce our emissions. And a lot of farm practices inhibit proper emissions reductions. And I think Jerry's right as well around there is a mismatch between what we're saying at a national level and how it's filtered down to the individual farmer who feels threatened, whose income is at a difficult position and who's probably just completely focused on Brexit right now. So I think CAP reform will be enormous in this to incentivise farmers to reduce emissions, to say, for example, promote afforestation. I also think we need to change our strategy with Quilty around biodiversity so that it's not an industrialised forestry strategy, that we actually promote a greater mix of trees, that they're not there to be levelled. I think I met with the Irish Wildlife Trust, and when you see the destruction of wildlife across the country, I actually, and farmers, I think, will embrace that if there's an incentive to do it. But you can't just tell a farmer tomorrow to turn off the lights and start planting trees. There's a managed transition there that I actually think they would welcome and would be positive about if it filtered down to them. But when at the moment they're firefighting what they see as enormous threat to their livelihoods and their profitability, and I think, you know, we need to none of these. This transition isn't simplistic, and I think anyone who presents it that way is misleading everybody, because no, it never happens. But I also think from a European perspective, yeah. We have one arm of the European Commission, for example, agreeing Mercosur to flatten trees all over Brazil and to promote
to
massive
that beef
massive
that is much less efficiently
and flooded in the European market. And then we've got a very efficient beef production Ireland comparatively. So I think we have to manage all the different kind of plates of policy so that this happens in a better way.
But I can see Aisling there thinking, I've been hearing this for a long time. Sorry, Harry.
Yeah, Jerry was talking about suasion. I think a bit of the bottle has to be used as well. If you look at the Climate Action Plan, there were concrete, tangible targets in many sectors, say
not
a million
in agriculture.
EVs, insulation. But when you went to the agriculture sector, you came across a commodity that is in abundance in Ireland, that was lots of waffle and lots of waffle, and there were no targets. There were some good, Jerry talked about reducing nitrogen, they were talking about slurry spreading, new methods of spreading slurry that are more efficient, but when it came to the tangibles, there was very little in terms of concrete targets.
But isn't there a reason for that, Harry?
Sorry,
it's because of the nexus of politics and
but there wasn't,
there is a target of minus 15.
There is, but there was no. You talked about policies. You need to get a pathway to.
Oh
get
no,
there.
I don't disagree.
There was a complete absence of that. Yeah. And then when you went even to the forestation sector, where they said we want 8,000 extra hectares a year, but beyond that, there was very little information as to how that could be achieved. And that's going to be a very problematic thing to do, because it's not going to happen only on marginal land. Mm. It's going to happen on the best of land. And farmers have been very reluctant to cede any of their land to afforestation. And there's a big job of work to do to do there as well. And 8,000 hectares is not very ambitious in terms. It's not ambitious at all, in fact.
But wouldn't you be a brave man to stand up, or a woman to stand up in the Dáil and demand the stick to be introduced into this for farmers, but isn't that the real politic here? That's why we're not seeing it. That's why that document is full of waffle.
We have to set agriculture on a pathway that will achieve the targets that the government wants to achieve by 2030, and the only way they can do that is if they set out a plan. You need a plan. The plan might have to be adjusted and tweaked, but at the moment there is an absence of a plan, and that's what's required.
Doesn't the plan involve some kind of diversification?
It does.
We have to start producing other kinds of food.
We talk about agriculture as if it's a unitary thing, when it actually represents individuals, families, societies. Mm. You cannot in the morning just decide there's no more agriculture that emits carbon. It's not a sustainable or feasible thing to do, and we have to look at a situation where we're not making Irish agricultural products more expensive, thereby paving the way for example, the kind of beef from South America to come in and replace it, when it's a vastly more damaging to the environment than the beef we're producing here.
But
you have to approach the situation from a dual perspective.
On the diversification point, I would agree with Aisling there, but I think what has been absent in debate so far has been there's a need for realism as to what diversification actually means. I mean, I actually own a forest, but my neighbours, they're beef farmers simply because they can't do anything else on the land that they've got. The topography of the land alone limits opportunities except for trees. for forests. So diversification, yes, of course, everyone has to be in favour of that. We tend to talk about...
But it has to be practical, you're saying.
But niche opportunities. So when I think about diversification, I'm looking, for example, into the future where we will start using our grasslands, which we're the most efficient producer of grass in the world, actually. We will start producing grass in the future for energy, for example. We're doing some very interesting research on the extraction of proteins directly from grass, either for animal feed and ultimately, actually, for human consumption. Now, that's 20, 30 years down the road. So that's where I think the diversification has to take place.
Okay, sorry, John, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, I am. I'm intrigued as to how we're going to use grass for energy production when we don't have enough grass in Ireland. Despite using over 1 million tonnes of fertilisers a year, we can't produce enough grass to feed our current national herd. Last year, we imported 5.3 million tonnes of animal feeds. Much
okay,
of it, by
and
the
I
way...
It should be said last year was a very difficult year for
Katie,
fodder there, production
Katie, there are going
country.
To be lots
there are going to be
of
lots
difficult,
more difficult years.
Anyone who thinks, well, that was just a once-off, yeah. You're absolutely mistaken. We're very much mistaken. We have to accept the fact that we're in a situation where what we need to do on this island is to look towards a resilient and sustainable food production system. Mm. At the moment, our food production system seems to be geared towards producing, for example, huge amounts of milk powder for Chinese mothers, and also for, I think we're the number three importer into Saudi Arabia of milk powder for Saudi Arabian mums. Now, if that's what you think is the future for a resilient, sustainable agricultural system, I say that's fine. But I don't think we're not actually capable on this island of feeding ourselves if you cut us off for any reason from outside this island.
Sorry,
so I think
net
that's a really important point.
Sorry, no. In relation to food production, I mean, John, the facts are very straightforward. We export 90% of what we produce. We produce enough food for 35 million people, which is an extraordinary achievement.
No, we don't.
And secondly, in relation to your grass point, you're completely wrong on that. The facts of the matter are, we measure grass every day of the week. We know that we can.
We produce enough grass.
Can I finish my point?
We don't need to import all these
millions
of tons
of
feed, Gerald.
Last year was an exceptional year, and right now we are producing and utilising about 7.5 tons of grass. Per hectare. The potential is to double that. And we're on a trajectory to do that.
How do we double it?
And again, that's going to be part of the transformation.
How do we double it, Jerry?
Very simple. By first of all, I explained earlier on that we have identified a technology which allows us to completely eliminate the harmful emissions from nitrogen if you switch to protected urea. That's again another fact. But the best way to double grass, to increase grass production, is by simply measuring grass. We have developed a technology now which a farmer can consult through an app which allows them to manage the grass more effectively. That's already happening. There's extraordinary technological change taking place. But I agree, there needs to be a transformation.
Okay.
Policy needs to roll.
Okay. I just want to give you a flavour of what, because we're getting a massive reaction on to this on texts coming in and tweets, concerned citizen tweets. Until we deal with 100 companies responsible for 71% of global emissions, all the carbon taxes and herd culling in Ireland won't make a huge difference and will be difficult to convince the electorate ultimately. Another text says, an emergency has been declared and what's being done? Extinction Rebellion seems to be the only group mobilising for anything to be done. We need to mobilise now. Delighted to see you with Extension Rebels on the show. Neoliberal capitalism is destroying the planet, says Teresa. Our emissions from agricultural sources can be balanced and are being balanced by carbon sequestration.
Well, through forestry principally, but we can do a huge amount in relation to, I would love to see the restoration of hedgerows, for example, in our dairy farms.
But what about agroecology, where we have farms, where we have trees in the farming landscape? Yes. You know, that's what I have on my farm. Okay. We have fruit and nut trees planted on the farm itself and poultry under the trees.
The age of conventional farming is over. Farming in Ireland in 20 to 30 years' time will be unrecognisable to today. It's time for change. And then we have, like Brazil, Irish farmers are incentivised to flatten trees for grassland through CAP. If you have the number of cattle, you up the price of meat. And I've heard somebody else texting, I heard today the farmers in France are keeping cattle in and harnessing methane gas commercially. Is that something that's...
Well, anaerobic digestion would be an example of that. Okay. But the indoor system on the continent is actually has a much higher, carbon footprint.
Yeah, that's one thing. Okay, I'm going to have to take a break here. I had hoped we'd moved on from the agriculture sector by now, but we'll take this break anyway.
Email latedebate@rte.ie. The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
You're welcome back. We gave a thorough going over to agriculture there before the break. I want to move on to transport, though, because that's obviously a massive big-ticket item on, in our emissions as well. Harry, the Climate Action Plan, I recall the front of the transport section had a lovely picture of cyclists on bikes.
Oh, right.
But it was hugely focused on persuading people to buy electric cars.
It is, and that's a key part of the strategy, and I think they're probably putting too much emphasis on electric cars, because I think we'll have to, again, like agriculture and everything else, we'll have to really rethink how we move and why we move over the next 10 to 20 years. But the policy as such has an ambition of a million electric cars in Ireland by 2030, phasing out of diesel and petrol cars. And you'll see the progressive increase in carbon tax. It was a modest increase this budget of only €6. But the trajectory is that the carbon tax will be €80 per carbon tonne by 2030.
Just explain to people how wildly ambitious that target is. There's how many thousand, do you know, John, how many thousand electric cars on the road at the moment? Six or seven?
I'd say if it's 10,000, I'd be surprised.
Yeah, but it's actually, what's happening now, I mean, I remember as a child in Galway, there were at least two or three shops where they rented out colour TVs. And then, they were a really expensive item and they didn't make any economic sense. And then as the production increased, the price came down.
I'm told O'Connor TV in Shop Street was...
O'Connor TV in Shop Street, yeah. And RTV, I think, as well, on Eglinton Street. We have a Galway producer out there. I think as this decade goes, the graph will begin to rise and rise very steeply indeed.
But
I think
where does that get us, though, if we're still getting so much of our electricity from...
Well, I mean, in the long term, the idea is that the energy will be mostly renewable energy. I think some of it will be nuclear energy because we have this Celtic interconnector coming from France. But they do envisage that Money Point will be gone by 2025, which a lot of people think is far too late. And as we see, they're beginning to close down the peat-generating power stations at present. But, I mean, the battery technology is improving all the time. So, I mean, very soon you're going to get the Tesla 3 coming into to Ireland that has a range of 450 kilometres an hour.
But it's also hugely expensive.
It's over 50,000. And all electric cars are very expensive now compared to ordinary cars. But I think in 2022, 2023, you'll get to a stage where the cost of buying an electric car will be justified in terms of its long-term cost vis-a-vis a petrol or diesel car.
But just generally in terms of the emphasis for reducing emissions from the transport sector on this shift to electric vehicle driving, is there enough being done on the other issues, which is obviously public transport?
There's not enough being
done. And active transport, cycling.
Cycling, walking, there's not enough being done. I mean, budget allocation to cycling was paltry in comparison to roads. And there was a very good report that was produced by an all-party committee on climate change last year, but there were a couple of key areas of disagreement. And one related to the...
Carbon tax was one of them.
Carbon tax was one, but the other one related to investment in public transport vis-a-vis roads. And the Green Party and the Labour Party and I think Sinn Féin and People Before Profit wanted a 2-to-1 ratio in favour of public transport over roads, whereas the government party plus Fianna Fáil outflanked them essentially and voted for a 2-to-1 ratio the other way. And I think we need to change that and change that.
Could I say something about transport in rural areas? Because I'm a rural dweller and we have to be at the moment dependent on cars. But actually, you know, Ireland has more road kilometres per person than any other country in the world because we have this extensive system of back roads in the country in rural areas. Every single one of them prioritised for motor vehicles. Why could we not take some of those back road routes reduce the speed limit to 20 kilometres an hour and prioritise them for bicycles, pedestrians and horses. And then in the meantime, and then while we get people used to that, put in some good public transport, small electric buses regularly going.
What about Eamon Ryan's idea that he floated this week, that they be car sharing in villages?
Yeah, absolutely.
The idea that
community vehicles,
300 people in a village have 30 cars between them and they share them.
Yeah.
Is that really realistic though?
I'm afraid it's up there with the wolves.
Certainly, I'll tell you what's not realistic. Every single individual having a car. That's not realistic. That's what's driving this crisis. We have got to be more imaginative and a bit braver, a bit more courageous. Our politicians need to lead us on this.
And Barry Ward, be imaginative and courageous.
Well, I'd like to think I am, Katie, but it's not about saying to a village that, sorry, you can only have so many cars between you, particularly when you have a situation where, as you've identified, Ashley, they are the people who perhaps need their cars the most, and perhaps we should be turning to the urban communities and encouraging them to use public transport and cycling and walking to a much greater extent. The Green Party, unfortunately, have put forward these ideas that I don't think are realistic and I don't think are realisable. At the same time, they criticise the government for focusing on individual responsibility and saying to them, it's not about individual responsibility. The government must take responsibility. And while there's some truth to that, at the end of the day, the government can do all it wants. But if people don't understand that they need to make a change in their behaviour, nothing will change.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because George Monbiot, the big environmental campaigner, has a piece in The Guardian today where he says the biggest trick that corporate world played on us all was to convince us that it was our problem and our fault.
Yeah, well, he's not wrong about that, and I know George Monbiot, and I've read a number of his books, but the point is you have to differentiate between government and corporations in that regard. He's quite right. The vast majority of emissions in the world come from a small number of corporations. That is undoubtedly the case.
20 and companies responsible for 35%
of
emissions.
And governments must deal with that. But in terms of the kind of things we've just been talking about, transport, for example, which is the greatest source of emissions in Ireland in real terms, that is something that does require individual responsibility. So if you want people to get out of their cars, obviously the government and local government...
No, it's not individual responsibility. I would love to cycle, but there's nothing to cycle on.
If you'd let me finish what I was going to say, is obviously government and local government particularly have a role in providing the facilities that make it easy and attractive for people to do
but
that.
You just, we but just heard that you just heard that at the Climate Change Committee, when the decision was being made to support public transport and cycling and that, and versus the roads, that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael plumped for the roads.
No, but that doesn't mean that you're not also producing quality products at a ground level for people to encourage them to take cycling. And I'm involved in a number of those initiatives in Donegal right down at the moment, for example. But people still must make the choice to get out of the big comfy car and get on the bike.
If you take, for example, Bus Connects in Dublin,
a lot of people out there would say, please do.
The problem with Bus Connects is that it doesn't properly integrate. It's not ambitious enough around building kind of consent patterns of community cycling that are a lot of the experts in London that we had at the Climate Change Committee have outlined. Also, it doesn't integrate rail capacity and the electrification of the rail line. So we're kind of going down silos around public transport without integrating public transport in our cities and making it more affordable.
But if we continue to fund new roads and improvement in roads, you are building in hard infrastructure that's going to encourage more car use.
What do you say to somebody where there's been a number of black spots on a rural road where a number of people have been killed? Do you say starve that road of investment and let more people die in that road? Or do you say, it's a simplistic argument. Of course we need more investment in public transport, and everyone across the political spectrum supports that. And we need to have more ambitious targets. For example, in our cities, as Harry mentioned, active transport, I think, could play a huge role here. But I know in my own area, we've been starved of investment in terms of building better cycling infrastructure, making it safe to cycle. And I think the hypothecated fund from a carbon tax should be used to build more greenways, to have segregated cycle lanes, actually show people the actual material change.
I want to let John.
I mean, behaviour follows infrastructure. My kids, who are now teenagers, even though they're at a suitable distance for school for cycling, they've never been allowed by their parents to cycle to school because it's too dangerous, because the roads are choked with cars that are getting bigger every year. Now they're choked with SUVs. And so that's part of it. And the second part is, we need to look at this systematically. A typical private car is parked for about 95 to 98% of the time. So this idea of car sharing, especially we all have apps in our pockets now, the idea of actually having a limited number of cars that we can share using technology is not pie in the sky, and we shouldn't shoot it down. We need to use smart solutions to some of these. If you've got a car that is sitting there 95% of the time, why not come up with a car sharing app? Let's look at our insurance industry so that we can reform this.
Can I just make a comment on the car sharing idea? And I live in a rural area, very rural area. I just couldn't see how that could work because people travel in all sorts of different directions out of small communities.
But
what I do want to say, though, is, I mean, what I find really encouraging about a lot of the movements, the popular movements around environment, is that they're community-based. And I think there are huge opportunities in rural communities in particular for community responses. Maybe not in the car pooling idea, but say in energy. For example.
I'm told I have to take a break now. Apologies. Okay. We'll go to a break right now.
Email latedebate@rte.ie. The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And I'm afraid that's all we have time for tonight. Jerry, if you'll sit down, we're saying goodbye to people. Irish Examiner leading with, of course, that story, Leaders Upbeat on Pathway to Brexit Deal. Everyone going with that. The Daily Telegraph, deal can be done by October 31st, say Irish. And Britain and Ireland on Pathway to Agreement, says The Times. Tonight's programme was produced by Brian Lally. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was David Field. Tommy Sullivan was O'Sullivan was on sound. I want to thank my panel. Unfortunately, we didn't get to everything we wanted to talk to tonight, but we will have them back again. And now it's over to Colin Murray on Late Date.